Bosma went missing in 2013, he left his wife and two-year-old daughter at home to take two men who said they wanted to buy his truck on a test drive.
According to the evidence, those men, Thelen Millard and Mark Smitch, had planned for a year to find a used Dodge 3500 pickup truck through online classifieds, steal it, and kill its owner.
They had found Tim Bosma's body.
Police also found the truck in this trailer at Millard's mother's house.
Tim Bosma was abducted, shot, and killed in his truck, his body incinerated hours later by the two accused. Charlene Bosma broke down as she testified. He said, "When they come, should I go with them? I said, yes, because we want our truck to come back." Bosma never came back. His truck was found days later on Millard's mother's property. Investigators also discovered an incinerator near Millard's home. Inside, dozens of bone fragments, even a tooth. On its outside, more of Bosma's blood. Despite the case against him, Millard was regularly smiling in court. In the days before Tim Bosma's disappearance, police discovered a man by the name of Evan made similar inquiries with three different truck sellers, even taking a test drive. Today, the Crown pointed out Thelen Millard's middle name is Evan. On top of that, a witness is expected to testify. The man looking at the trucks had a tattoo of the word ambition written on his wrist. Millard also has that tattoo.
For 3 years, we have been in and out of this courthouse, forced to look at and breathe in the same space with the utter depths of depravity in our society. We have had to endure being near the two men that walked down my driveway on May 6, 2013 and took away the bright life in our lives that was Tim. For Tim's murderers, their life sentence begins now, and ours began over 3 years ago when they murdered Tim. That being said, although we endure a life sentence without Tim, we have learned to collectively laugh again, to smile, and embrace what we still have. We have memories, a lot of very beautiful memories.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I am Jill.
And I'm Dick.
And tonight's episode is called Thrill Kill, The Murder of Tim Bosma. Now, it was on May 6, 2013 that husband and father Tim Bosma took two strangers for a test drive in his 2007 Dodge 3500 truck that he was trying to sell. It was around 8:30 p.m. and Tim and his wife Charlene had just put their two-year-old daughter to bed for the night. It was getting late and Tim paced the house. His cell phone rang and he went out front. Two men walked up the driveway. The men introduced themselves, took a cursory look at the truck, and the three men left for a test drive. Tim Bosma would never be seen by his wife again. Days later, investigators found Tim's remains at the bottom of an animal incinerator on a farm in the nearby town of Ayr. Why was Tim Bosma's life taken that night? As it turns out, the men who killed Tim Bosma had no regard for his life. His murder was planned and carried out in a senseless, thrill-seeking, deliberate act of violence. Tim was a random target. One of his killers was a spoiled, wealthy young man who has also been charged in the murders of his own father and a former girlfriend. Now, this case was recommended to the brewery by one of our loyal listeners, Karen. Karen was kind enough to bring it to our attention, and I was surprised we'd never heard of this case, so thank you, Karen.
Well, you know, once you cross the border into Canada, we don't hear too much about things that occur in Canada. Has to be United States.
Yeah.
But I'm sure Canada, even though they're probably more peace-loving than us United States people,
I always think of them that way.
They still have their share of compelling crimes.
Okay. Now, in our discussion, we're going to do our best to show respect for the life of Tim Bosma and for the loss that his family has endured, as we try to in every case that we do. Now, we found it unavoidable to give some attention to the history and the lifestyles of Tim's killers, but our focus is on the victim in this case and the other victims related to this case. We tell this story in honor of their memories. Now, I've said my piece. Dick has a Canadian beer coming up. But first, let's share some recent five-star reviews. So, let's see. I've got True Crime Touchdown by Jetta's Goodies.
All right.
I love this podcast. The hosts, Jill and Dick, are an adorable married couple with fantastic chemistry and a hilarious dry humor. I love how she keeps him in line while always keeping her cool. Thank you for all the hard work. My current favorite beer suggestion would be Bell's Two Hearted from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Cheers from the microbrew beer capital of the world, Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Well, certainly next time we do a Michigan crime, Two Hearted would be very close to the top of the list, because that is an exquisite beer.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, Jetta's Goodies, welcome to the brewery.
Welcome.
The next one is One of My Favorites by Mal Howard. I really love True Crime Brewery. The hosts are soft-spoken and thoughtful. I appreciate Dick's medical knowledge and Jill's online research into the cases. There's not a lot of production value, but I like this format for a change from the many other True Crime podcasts I listen to. Please keep up the good work. So, Mal Howard, welcome to the brewery.
Welcome.
And Geeky is the New Sexy. Great podcast, great hosts who present great content by Blue Jeep. So welcome to the brewery, Blue Jeep.
Way to go, Blue Jeep.
And what have we got for a beer today, Dick?
Well, we have, like you said, a Canadian beer. Now, the only small thing about this is that the crime took place in the largely English-speaking part of Canada. And my beer is from Montreal, which is obviously the French-speaking part of Canada.
Yep.
But I didn't differentiate. I just figured a Canadian beer would serve. So I went to a brewery called Brasserie du Decil, which is located in Montreal, and I picked probably their flagship beer, Peche Mortelle, which is French for mortal sin. So I thought that was kind of apt for our discussion tonight anyway. And it's a world-class beer to begin with. So it's an American double or imperial stout, which I've had before and I've discussed before. And as I've said, that these are stouts that take some inspiration from the Russian Imperial Stout. Many are barrel-aged, mostly bourbon or whiskey barrels. Some are infused with coffee or chocolate. The alcohol varies, but tends to be on the big side, and they tend to be sweet and full-bodied. Now, Peche Mortelle is a stout with coffee, and you can really tell that.
Okay.
So, in my ever-present snifter, it's a dark black-colored beer. With a thick mocha head that lingered quite nicely. So it's a kind of a pretty beer.
Does it leave lace when you drink it?
It does.
Okay.
It has a very strong aroma of coffee. I mean, you smell it and you think you're in a Starbucks or someplace.
Oh, I like that smell. Yeah.
Very intense espresso taste, some dark chocolate, and burnt fruit, interestingly. So there's some sweetness there, too. This is a smooth, creamy, extremely well-balanced beer. So if you have a chance to drink this, by all means do so, because it is a wonderful beer.
Thank you. Well, that's a good beer, Dickie. Why don't you come on down to the end of the bar with me where it's quiet?
I'll do that.
And we can talk about Tim Bosma.
I think the end of the bar looks pretty desolate, so let's liven it up a little.
Okay. So, on May 6th of 2013, Tim Bosma had been trying to sell his truck online for weeks. He and Charlene, his wife, were parents of a two-year-old, and money was tight. The 2007 Dodge had already required a new transmission and other repairs. Selling it would save future expenses and bring in a little cash. Charlene posted ads for the truck online, and the men who responded on May 6th said that they would come and see it that night. Now, Tim asked his wife, when they come, should I go with them? Charlene answered, yes, you should go, because we want the truck to come back. She had no idea, of course, but she would live to regret her answer.
No kidding. That's a bad omen right there.
It's a bad thing to live with. Now, when the two men, now known to be Dellen Millard and Mark Smitch, arrived at the Bosma home around 9 p.m., on foot, they said a friend had dropped them off and gone to a nearby Tim Hortons for coffee. Now, according to Charlene, the taller man seemed normal. He was clean-cut with brown hair and a beard. But the second man hung back while Millard spoke to Bosma.
So Millard was the
first man
who looked okay and was doing the talking.
Right, the taller man. He was clean-cut with brown hair and a beard. The second man, who we now know as Smitch, hung back while Millard spoke to Bosma. He didn't seem sociable, and she described him as sketchy, wearing an oversized hoodie with the hood up, and he kept his hands in his pockets.
Never a good thing to be described as sketchy.
No. Now, Charlene said Tim talked to the taller man, and he walked over to her, he gave her a smile, and he said he was going on a short test drive with these guys and would be right back. Charlene had been in the garage sharing a smoke with Wayne DeBauer, their downstairs tenant and friend, And when Tim got into the truck's passenger side and the truck drove off, Charlene turned to Wayne, and she said, "That's weird." Wayne agreed, and he cracked a joke. "That might be the last time we ever see him."
What a horrible joke, as it turns out.
As it turns out. Of course, he didn't know, but it's very eerie to think that he said that now.
Yeah. I mean, in retrospect, you're thinking that both the wife and the friend had bad vibes about these guys.
Yeah. But how many times in your life do you have these bad vibes and you let it go?
I know.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to sell the truck and they seem okay, so let's get this over with and see if we can make the sale.
Sure. Yeah, so it was the last time that she saw him. We know now he vanished that night. He wasn't targeted for who he was. By all accounts, he was a hard-working and kind young man, loved by his family and their tight-knit community. Although Tim was the victim of a long-term planned murder, he was just chosen at random from a pool of people who were selling Dodge Diesel 3500 trucks online. If Tim had been selling a Chevy or a Ford, he'd still be alive today. Dellen Millard wanted a diesel Dodge truck, and he didn't want to buy it. Tim Bosma's murder was the darkest act in a series of escalating criminal acts, led by Dellen Millard with a group of wayward followers who were seeking thrills.
So I'm going to bring up some of Millard's background and history, just to put things in perspective, and maybe to show what a psychopath, I'm presuming, or sociopath. I don't know if he has a psychiatric diagnosis, but he's definitely one of those. So he was a kid, an adult. He was born into wealth. His grandfather, Carl Millard, started his own charter airline in 1954. At its peak, Millard Air had a flight of 21 planes. So that's good.
Yeah, that's significant.
Now, hard times did come upon them. They eventually filed for bankruptcy in 1990. But the family still maintained their wealth. They continued to operate an aircraft servicing and maintenance company at Toronto's Pearson International Airport.
Okay.
So they still had money.
They absolutely did, yeah.
Millard's childhood was privileged. He attended the Toronto French School, which is an elite private school. In 1999, when he was 14, he qualified as an airplane and helicopter pilot, which probably not too many 14-year-olds do.
No, I think he set a record there. I think he was the youngest person to do that.
Now, apparently he wasn't that interested in school. He didn't go to college. He did attend some vocational classes after high school, but never followed through with anything.
Mm-hmm.
But what did stick with him was partying. In his early 20s, he was well known to local high school students as a drug dealer and a party host. So he had his own house.
Yes, he did. He had more than one house.
Kids described him as charming and mysterious, which I'm sure if you're a teenager and you've got this guy with money and houses and stuff, yeah, it'd be charming.
Sure.
His house backed into a golf course. He had several vehicles in the garage, and video game setups were available throughout the house. There was also a pool. He had seemingly endless amounts of money to spend. The good life.
Yeah. Yeah, the word got around that you could easily get drugs at Millard's place. He kept a supply, they said, in a black and yellow Stanley toolbox. One of Millard's friends, who was arrested but ultimately not charged for involvement in Tim Bosma's case, met Millard in 2007. Millard let him drive some of his cars and once let him live at his house rent-free for about 5 weeks.
Which friend was this?
Well, we'll see.
Okay.
This is not the one you're thinking. Millard let him drive some of his cars, as we said, and he lived with him. And then also Millard paid the bar and restaurant bills and paid for a couple's vacation. Yeah, so he paid for a couple's vacation with Mikulski and their two girlfriends to the British Islands.
Boy, this guy had a good deal.
Now Millard,
this Mikulski.
Yes. Now Millard and his friends liked to steal for the fun of it also. He called these thefts missions as if it were all a game. And the thefts started small, but they quickly escalated to thefts of motorcycles and even city-owned construction vehicles prior to the murder taking place.
So, yeah, it looks and sounds like he started small and gradually increased.
Yeah, that's how most things go, right?
Right. You get away with some stuff. You think you can do bigger heists.
Yeah, you move up.
You keep getting away with it.
Yep.
Move on up.
Now, what Millard really did was he collected aimless young people who he could easily persuade to help him with his schemes, his missions. And Andrew Mikulski was one of his heist buddies. And so was Mark Smitch. Now, he met Smitch in 2008, and he became his most trusted co-conspirator.
Yeah, I mean, both these guys are kind of beholden to Millard. You know, he's paying all their bills and stuff.
Yeah, he's kind of buying friends, isn't he?
What a good deal. Mm-hmm. So sure, I'll do stuff with you.
Right. Smitch sold drugs, and that's how he initially met Millard. Smitch told his girlfriend that Millard was like a brother to him. He did some odd jobs at the Millard Air Hangar and some maintenance at some of Millard's properties. Millard didn't pay money to Smitch. He bought Smitch clothing and food. He let Smitch and his girlfriend live in one of his houses. Now, when Smitch pulled off a heist with Millard, Millard would give him cash. And he also promised to build a music studio for Smitch, who fancied himself as a rapper and wanted to become the next Eminem, I guess.
Yeah, what is it with all these low-class white guys that think they want to be rappers?
Well, they're not all low-class, and rapping is, it's an art.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Now, when Millard wanted to buy a gun, Smitch introduced him to Matthew Ward Jackson, who sold Millard the gun used to kill Tim Bosma. The gun Millard bought was a Walther PPK, the kind of gun James Bond used.
Right.
Now, this fed into his idealized version of the criminal life. While texting with Ward Johnson about the gun purchase, Millard asked if it was clean or dirty. Clean was Ward Jackson's reply. Millard wrote, "By the time I let her go, she'll be a dirty girl."
Jeez, what an asshole.
Yeah. He believed he was too smart to be caught. Before a heist, he would scope out the area, then he would send a text to his buddies to be on the lookout, while he and Smitch stole whatever they were going out to steal.
Well, we're going to see that they weren't very smart.
No, actually.
They were pretty fucking
pretty
stupid.
Pretty fucking dumb, yeah. That's right. Not impressive.
No.
No.
So they're not as smart as they think they are, or he's not as smart as he thinks he is.
Not at all. Not at all.
So although Millard seemed to have plenty of money, there's plenty of evidence to believe that he never really thought he had enough money.
Sure.
So back to a little bit of previous history.
Okay.
Dellen's father was Wayne Millard,
mm-hmm.
who was the owner of the business. He had plans to shift the business to a fixed-based operation in 2012. So he was making plans to make some significant changes in the business.
Yes, he was.
So all of a sudden, in November of 2012, Dad Wayne was found dead of a gunshot wound to his eye, and I guess to his brain.
I would imagine it's behind there.
It was originally ruled a suicide, but Dellen Millard was later charged with first-degree murder in his father's death.
That's right.
So I can see that. I mean, it sounds like maybe the seemingly unending supply of money is going to be dwindling, and he's going to be looking out for himself, so Dad's got to go.
Yeah, seems that way.
And it turns out within days of Wayne's death, most of the company's employees were laid off, and Dellen canceled his father's business plans.
Dellen, yeah.
Dellen.
I haven't heard of Dellen before, have you?
Never.
Oh, huh, and you hear all the different kids' names.
So former Millard Air bookkeeper Lisa Williams said that the company took out a $3.7 million loan in October 2012. So that's just before Wayne was found dead.
Mm-hmm.
The loan was to build a 50,000 square foot hangar at the Waterloo, Ontario airport. And so it was built, but he died and never brought in any revenue.
Right.
But with Dellen in charge of things, so he's the boss, the business and everything was passed to him with his father's death.
Sure.
The hangar was never used for aircraft business. It looked like it was used for personal business. He used it to store his vehicles. He used it to store his stolen property. It looked like to the police when they did raid it and investigate it that it was a chop shop.
Mm-hmm.
So he also, in 2013, early 2013, sent a text to Michalski, his buddy, saying he needed to make $100,000 a month to get out of debt.
Yeah, he said that his father had left him debt.
Well, and he wasn't doing anything to try to get out of it. This hangar was sitting empty, not being used for anything.
Well, yeah, he didn't want to make money in an honest way.
Not being used for anything legal.
Sure.
Right? So later, when Michalski was interviewed, he maintained that he believes Millard stole things for the thrill of it.
It seems that way.
And it escalates.
Yeah. Now, Shane Schlotzman was a mechanic who did work for many of Millard's cars. And around 2012, in the early months of 2012, Millard asked Schlottman to build him an incinerator. He said he needed it to burn off garbage from his properties. But that was only one of the lies that Millard told to explain his need for an incinerator. He later told Schlottman he wanted an incinerator to get into the pet cremation business with his uncle. That's a real up-and-coming business, I guess.
Well, sure.
His uncle, Robert Burns, and Robert Burns says that that was never discussed with him. It was never anything that he was planning.
So it's news to Robert Burns that he was going to be in the pet cremation business.
Yes.
But that also speaks, if he's inquiring as to this is like a year or so before they killed the guy.
Yes. Yes, they were planning way in advance.
It was a very well-advanced plan.
Yes. Yeah, Millard told his girlfriend, Christina Nudga, that he needed it to melt down metal from his airport business. But of course, we know the business had no clients.
Right.
He didn't really have an airport business going on. He
and if you look at hangar. It, so that's three different stories about why he needs the incinerator.
Mm-hmm. But Schlottman did build him an incinerator out of three 50-gallon drums. I saw pictures of this on YouTube. And it was pretty much just three 50-gallon drums stacked on top of each other and welded together. But the first time that Schlottman tried to ignite it, it blew up.
well-built incinerator.
Right. So Millard asked Schlottman to research professional livestock incinerators. So he wasn't giving up on this. It's really weird that he was this focused on something like that.
Yeah, and if he's going to use it in his murder scheme.
Yeah.
You would think he'd make sure that basically nothing was left.
Well, and it just doesn't make sense. So the incinerator that Millard ended up purchasing cost over $15,000. It was called the Eliminator. It was 3 meters tall and it weighed 2,700 kilograms.
That's 5,500 pounds or more than 5,500. This is huge.
Right. It advertised that it could cremate up to 225 kilograms of animal carcass in a few hours.
Wow.
So he asked Schlottman to modify it to make it mobile, and he installed it on a trailer with a propane tank and a generator. It ended up costing well over $20,000, which, need I say, he could have just bought a truck for that amount of money. So that goes along with the theory that this was just for the thrill of it. He didn't need to do this.
No, he didn't need it, but it wasn't going to satisfy his mind to buy the truck.
Right.
And he was never going to just buy the truck. He was going to either steal the truck or steal the truck and kill the owner of the truck, but he wasn't just ever going to buy the truck.
Right. Now, Millard was obsessed with off-road racing as well as theft, and he wanted that diesel Dodge 3500 pickup to tow his racing Jeep to Mexico for the Baja 500 race.
So it had to be the Dodge 3500. That's the only thing that can tow his truck, his Jeep.
Well, I guess the last year that he did it with a different truck that used regular gasoline, and it cost a lot more money, which makes no sense.
No.
So this was going to be cheaper if he got a diesel.
Jeez. So that's part of their program. They need this particular truck.
Yeah.
So that's what they're looking for.
Well, that's what they got in their heads.
And
so,
like you said earlier, if he had a different make of truck, he'd still be alive.
Yeah. So Millard's plans to steal a diesel Dodge 3500 started back in early 2012. The police were able to determine this by reading Millard and Smitch's texts.
Yeah, so these guys were real criminal masterminds.
Yeah. Their plan at first was to smash and grab the truck. They scoped out many trucks online between early 2012 and May of 2013. But they had trouble finding the situation they wanted. Either the setting wasn't secluded enough, or the truck was moved before they got to it.
So over time, their strategy evolved to setting up meetings with sellers using a prepaid phone. Millard brought a burner phone and registered it under the name Lucas Bate. The prosecution, which is called the Crown in Canada, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I like that.
Said that their plan evolved further to include the incinerator and the gun. Now, I would think that if he'd been talking about this incinerator for a while, I mean, that was already in the plan. The gun maybe was new.
Mm-hmm.
So Millard set up multiple test drives with people selling Dodge 3500s. One of these was a Toronto man named Omar Palmilli. On the day of the planned test drive, Palmilli fell asleep and missed the call, so they never tested his truck.
Wow.
But I guess Basma wasn't so lucky at that.
Right, not at all.
We'll probably never know exactly what happened to Tim Basma in the truck.
Mm-hmm.
At the trial, Millard and Smitch blamed each other for the shooting. Of course, that's how you do it.
Yeah.
After the murder, Millard and Smitch soon realized that they had left a careless trail of evidence. So they went ahead, they stripped the interior of Basma's blood-soaked truck. They burned the pieces they had cut out in a field at Millard's farm, which left two huge patches of scorched land.
Yeah.
Once the incinerator was cool enough to move, they moved it from the hangar to the farm.
Yeah. Now, Millard also thought that if he changed the license plates and the VIN number with those from his truck and gave it a new paint job, that Basma's truck could pass for his own. So he'd actually called an auto painting company and asked about bringing it in and having that done. But the next morning on May 7th, Millard sent a group text to his employees telling them not to come to work that day, that no one was to come by the hangar even to pick up anything. And that was the first time that had ever happened.
That's suspicious, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
of course, at the time, you know, you're an employee, you don't know. So you just say, okay, I get a day off.
Well, yeah, but this is all, you know, they're not very swift, really. They're not as smart as they think they are, as you said.
No.
No.
They're actually really pretty stupid.
Yeah, they've gone through all this, and there's no reason for it, and it's just terrible.
I mean,
and they stupid.
They left plenty of indicators that they were the people that were guilty of the crime.
Sure, sure.
I mean, that's an easy case to solve.
Yep. It ended up being that way. It sure did.
So one of the Millard Air employees was a guy named Shane Slatchman. His father-in-law was Arthur Jennings.
Yeah, we talked about Shane Slatchman earlier. He was the one that helped to build the incinerator.
He helped with the incinerator. But his father-in-law,
worked
Arthur
there
Jennings,
too.
Worked there. So Jennings went to the hangar on May 8th. He immediately noticed a black Dodge pickup sitting on a tarp.
Mm-hmm.
He thought he recognized it from the news coverage of Tim Basma's disappearance.
I know. Can you imagine?
Yeah. You walk in, you say, whoa, I know that truck.
Mm-hmm.
So when Jennings asked Schlatzman about the truck, he said Millard told him he had bought the truck from someone in Kitchener.
Mm-hmm.
Jennings noticed that the inside of the truck was stripped and the plates were removed. He couldn't stop thinking about Charlene Basma's impassioned plea for her husband's return.
Yeah, it had been on the news that he was missing, that his family was looking for him, and it was actually quite heartbreaking.
Yeah, but this guy Jennings didn't do exactly that. He did sort of the right thing, but
yeah,
he didn't.
Took him too long. That's
didn't
for sure.
Follow through quickly enough.
Yeah, it was on May 9th, so that's 3 days later, that Jennings got to work. He came in early and he took photos of the truck's VIN number. Then he did phone Crime Stoppers in nearby Brantford to check the VIN number to see if it matched Basma's truck's VIN number. But Jennings didn't tell Crime Stoppers where the truck was. He first confronted
father-in-law.
Son-in-law. So he confronted his son-in-law, Shane Slotsman. Slotsman told him that Millard had bought the truck from Kitchener. So when he confronted Slotsman, Slotsman told Millard that Jennings had called Crime Stoppers.
Right.
So Jennings tells his son-in-law. His son-in-law tells Millard that Jennings had told him this, and so that doesn't look very good for either of them.
No, it doesn't.
Really not being that helpful.
No.
So Millard immediately got the truck out of the hangar, and he got his girlfriend, Christina Nudka, to help him with the cover-up.
Yep.
Now, he drove with Christina to his farm late that night, towing Basma's truck in a huge trailer, and Millard and Nudka moved the Eliminator out of the barn on the farm and onto a wooded path nearby. Nudka insists that Millard told her they were moving it because the floorboards under the Eliminator were creaking. So, this incinerator, the Eliminator.
Yeah, this 5,000, 6,000-pound thing. I can see where it might make floorboards creak.
Yeah, I don't know.
But he's...
I don't really believe
course,
her either.
And the pictures we saw, though, I mean, he left it out in plain sight.
He did.
It wasn't hidden anyplace.
No.
I mean, he might have moved it from the barn to a field or an area on the farm, but it was still sitting out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough to hide a 5,000-pound piece of equipment.
I know. So on the way back to Millard's home on the early morning of May 10th, they stopped at Millard's friend Matt Hagerman's house. Millard convinced Hagerman to hold onto his toolbox for him. This was the toolbox where Millard had kept his drugs in the past. You know, the black and yellow Stanley toolbox?
The Stanley toolbox.
Now, Millard handed Hegerman the black and yellow toolbox, and it was fastened with a padlock. And that was around 4 a.m. on May 10th that he gave that to him. And expected him to hide it for him, I guess.
Yeah, or get rid of it for him. I mean, he didn't want it being around any place.
Yeah, I think he ended up hiding it at his parents or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people were not that helpful with solving this crime, and even though they eventually all fell away from supporting Millard, he did have a lot of support in the beginning. A lot of people preventing justice from happening in a timely fashion.
Yeah, and you would have thought they'd come forward. I mean, they know that it's a homicide, or at least has all the appearances of a homicide.
Sure.
So let's do the right thing.
Yeah, a lot of them did not do the right thing.
Nope.
No.
There's another interesting sidelight in this quest for the Dodge 3500.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got the unfortunate victim who with his truck.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the lucky guy who was asleep and never returned the call.
Yes, that's right.
Then we have another guy. His name is Igor Tumanenko.
Tumanenko.
He was also trying to sell a Dodge 3500. And he went on a test drive with Millard and Smitch. So he wasn't a victim, obviously.
Yes.
He may have been passed over.
Was this the day before Tim Bosma went out, or did they say when that was?
It just says the spring of 2013.
Okay.
So it was before Bosma.
Okay.
Tumanenko may have been passed over because he's a pretty big, muscular guy.
Yeah.
And he has a military background.
Mm.
So during the test drive, he said he talked to Millard about the truck's suspension and engine. Tumanenko told Millard he was familiar with the engine from his time in the Israeli army. And then that got Smitch. So Smitch asked him what he did in the army, and Tumanenko said, "You don't want to know."
Well.
So I'm thinking, Israeli army, you don't want to know what I did? This guy's a tough bastard.
Right.
And interestingly, the test drive ended moments later, and he's still alive. Tumanenko.
Right.
But he did help because he remembered the ambition tattoo on Millard's wrist.
Right.
And reported that to the police.
Yeah, so it was on May 10th that the police actually visited Millard Air Hangar to question Millard. And when they told him they were investigating Tim Bosma's disappearance, Millard's response was, "I thought you were going to say that."
Jeez.
Yeah.
He's bright.
Yeah. Millard had been under surveillance, actually, since Tumanenko. Is that how you said that?
Yes.
Tumanenko identified him. They pulled his phone records and found that his cell phone had been pinging off of similar phone towers at the same time as the burner phone on the day that Bosma disappeared. So we had this burner phone that Smitch had, and then we had Millard's regular cell phone pinging off similar towers so as
they,
it went. So we knew they were together.
They seem in the same place at the same time.
Yeah, so both these phones were in the same place at the same time on the day that Bosma disappeared. So there's another thing. They're just stupid as well as evil. So when they arrested Millard, he had $3,000 in cash, and he also had black nitrile gloves that were later found to have Tim Bosma's DNA and blood on them. So it's like OJ all over again. I mean, they really... You thought he was smart? I don't get it.
No.
No. He and Smitch seemed to think that they had this kind of James Bond kind of going on a mission thing going on. And they were just idiots that ruined a good person's life for no reason.
They were.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many clues.
Yeah.
About them being implicated in the crime.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't see how this mastermind criminal.
Yeah, not really.
No.
No, not at all, really.
Mm-mm.
So, Smitch finds out that Millard's been arrested. He calls Andrew Michalski in a panic.
Yeah.
Because we got a buddy up here. Michalski, who is living in Millard's house, rounded up everything Millard had and stuffed it into a blue backpack. He texted Hegerman, the toolbox recipient, and he told him that Millard would want everything to go to Smitch.
Okay.
So, Michalski and Hegerman drive together to take the toolbox and backpack to Smitch.
Mm-hmm.
But Hegerman heard on the car radio about Tim Bosma's disappearance and Millard's arrest.
Yeah, now up to this point, Hegerman had no idea that they had anything to do with a murder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although One would maybe think somebody drops off a toolbox that's locked and says, you got to keep this for me.
Well, I mean,
maybe there's something suspicious.
There'd already been a history of theft and drugs, and he probably thought that's all there was to it, I would think.
Yeah, all right. But he hears this on the radio, so he pulls into a strip mall and drops the toolbox and backpack in a maintenance stairwell and tells Smitch to pick it up himself.
Yeah.
So Smitch gets to the toolbox. He breaks off the lock and finds the gun that he thinks is the gun that Millard used to kill Tim Bosma.
Mm-hmm.
Smitch stashed the gun at his mother's house. What a son.
Yeah. Well, that's where he had been living up until he started hanging out with Millard. He and his girlfriend lived with his mother.
Jesus.
So these people who were hangers-on of Millard were not successful in life.
Not in the least.
It was kind of like a cult that pulled them in. He almost had like his own little cult going on.
So he's riding his BMX bike on May 22nd.
Okay.
This is after Millard's been arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just tooling along. Police arrest him also for first-degree murder.
Well, good.
When pressed for the location of the gun, he tells police that he buried it and couldn't remember where. So that was a strange move for him. I mean, if he's going to blame Millard being the only person to use the gun, it could have contained evidence to exonerate Smitch, if
right.
that were the case.
Sure.
So it sounds suspicious. Sounds like they're both involved, right?
Absolutely it does. Yeah.
So now that both Millard and Smitch were in jail, the rats are sinking, or deserting the sinking ship.
Sure.
All their buddies are leaving.
Yep. They don't want anything to do with this.
Well, no.
I mean, there's being a scumbag, and then there's being a scumbag.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
And
nobody wants to be a scumbag.
Stealing's okay. But
it's not
probably,
okay, but it's certainly not in the same
neighborhood. Well, I'm looking at it
neighborhood
from their
as murder.
Viewpoint.
Right.
So, you know, it's okay to steal things, because that's... something we that happens.
Victimless,
but
yeah.
Murder, wow.
Yeah, that's bad. So a lot of them are bailing out on him there.
Absolutely.
Sure. So Millard's in jail. He begins to plot his defense strategy at that point, and he actually rehearsed speeches to convince jurors of his innocence while he was in jail.
I'm sure this is going to go as well as his thoughts about how to avoid being caught.
Well, yeah, you're about right. Now, he wrote letters to his girlfriend, Christina Nudka, and he had them smuggled out of the prison to her. The letters were often and sometimes poetic, but they were riddled with spelling mistakes and just flowing with arrogance. The sentimentality of his letters to Nudka, professing his love and a desire to have a family with her, were absolutely insincere. He wanted her to help him in his trial, and that's pretty much what it came down to.
Sure.
Now, he concocted a story for Nudka to tell on the witness stand. In this story, Smitch already knew the Bosmas, and Millard wasn't even with Smitch when Smitch shot Tim Bosma.
It's all Smitch's fault.
Right. So, these best buddies who are like brothers, it didn't take them long to turn on one another.
Well, no. You're looking at murder.
And I don't know what to think of Christina Nudka. I mean, you saw some of these videos. What did you think? Did you think that she was aware that this was a murder when she helped out, or do you think that she was an innocent bystander?
Oh, no, she's not an innocent bystander.
No, I didn't think so either.
Neither Smitch's girlfriend.
Yeah.
They both knew more than they were letting on.
Sure, and possibly the mother, possibly Dellen Millard's mother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Millard told Nudka to destroy each note after she read it, but she didn't, so to her credit, she didn't do that. And in regard to Millard's communicating with her from jail, Nudka once said, "I was madly in love with him, but I was never sure how he felt about me. I kind of felt like I was being played."
Well, I'm sure she's correct in that.
Yep. So she said that Millard had delusions of grandeur and thought he was smart enough to get away with murder. And he believed his friends would lie under oath for him and that his girlfriend would destroy the letters, but he was wrong about these things. They didn't.
He was wrong big time.
Yeah.
I don't know why he thought that. Did he think he was so powerful?
Well, I think he was I think he was older than most of them. They said that he picked up most of these friends when he was in his early 20s and they were still in high school.
Yeah, but he's delusional.
Well, sure, he's definitely delusional. But they were kind of following him, and they did pretty much whatever he wanted. So once he was in prison, of course he thought, well, they're going to do what I want. They're going to get me out of here.
Sure.
I'm sure he thought, I'm not like anybody else. I can't go to prison. I'm special. Now, Millard was convicted of first-degree murder for killing Tim Bosma, and so was Smitch.
Now, there's some other people that have been found dead.
Yeah.
Besides the father.
Or not found at all, maybe?
Or not found at all. So we have the father, and Millard's been accused of that crime.
Wayne Millard, his father, yeah.
Right. Then we have a former girlfriend of Dellen Millard, whose name was Laura Babcock.
Yeah, this I just found out about after we'd already done most of the research for this.
This is interesting.
Pretty shocking, yeah.
So she's dating this guy. She was last seen on June 26, 2012. The last person she contacted on her phone was Millard. There were no more calls made from her phone after July 3rd, 2012.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another week or so.
Yep.
So, interestingly, both Millard and Smitch are going to be on trial this year for the first-degree murder of Laura Babcock.
Right.
They were convicted of Bosma's murder in June.
Mm-hmm.
Go straight to trial on Laura Babcock's case in October and November.
Right.
And as you mentioned before, Jill, he's also facing a first-degree murder charge in the shooting of his 71-year-old father, Wayne Millard.
Right.
So this is some guy.
Yeah, right.
So for Tim Bosma's family, the result of Millard and Smick's twisted and selfish actions is that they will forever be missing a son, a father, a husband, and a brother.
I know. And Tim Bosma didn't do anything to cause his own death, you know, except maybe to trust people, which we all do, right?
Sure. You're going to look at the good side of people.
We all know that life isn't fair, but I think we can reasonably expect that our lives won't be taken just for the thrills of a couple of sick, evil individuals. It seems like a reasonable thing for us to think. And that's why this case is so disturbing to all of us.
It's very disturbing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the cases we've done, for the most part, have been crimes of passion.
Yep.
You know, you look at the husband, the wife, or a relative, or, you know, there's usually kind of an explanation.
Yeah, but I mean, it's certainly not acceptable, but it's something that has...
There is.
It's based in some kind of human emotion.
And this guy, these guys, although I'm going to put most of the blame on Millard...
I think that's reasonable. I think he was definitely running the show.
Yeah. I mean, he's just evil incarnate.
And here we get to the whole question of nature versus nurture. And I think that there has to be a combination there. It doesn't seem like he was raised in any kind of super depraved way.
No, it doesn't.
Seems like he had a pretty easy life. Maybe not the perfect life, but certainly nothing to...
Yeah, I mean, we don't...
Justify this.
We don't know for sure. I mean, he was definitely brought up in wealth.
Yes.
And had the privileges that go along with that.
He did.
So, I'm sure he's kind of predisposed to his sociopathy.
Yeah, but very hedonistic. That's just to the extreme.
Absolutely.
To think that life is just... it kind of reminds me of that... the kid that had the drunk driving accident and killed all those people. And what was the phrase they used in that trial? Remember that?
Yeah.
He was a teenager. He had a house and a car, and he mowed down a bunch of people.
Affluency.
Affluenza. Yes. This kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah.
Where they really don't have love and support of parents, but they get all these things, and then they just expect more and more.
Yeah. You own everything, so you can do no wrong.
Right. So that's the nurture part, but I think there has to be a nature part to this as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, the kid did all that stuff because he was drunk. He wasn't planning on doing it.
No. No, he didn't purposely go out and kill people. That's different. But still, I think that there's a similar background there, a similar psychology in their behavior.
Yes. Sort of.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that those are two different episodes or two different... interpretation.
Yeah.
I mean, other than that they were both wealthy.
Well, they were both wealthy, and they both felt that they deserved whatever they wanted.
Right.
But this Millard took it to a whole new
Millard
level.
Millard went to a whole new level.
That's right. Yep. So it is really disturbing, and I hope that we can all take away from this the importance. And I don't mean to sound mushy. I know you're going to give me a look here, but can we all just take away from this the importance of loving one another, of having empathy, and some respect for all life?
I think we can certainly do that, particularly being respectful of others.
Yes. Yeah, because now Tim Bosma, who we haven't talked about enough in this, I wish we could have talked about him more, But there's not that much to say about someone who was good and normal and loving and just right. had his life taken away.
I mean, he's ordinary.
Yes.
In that sense.
In the best sense of the word.
Exactly. Right?
Ordinary is not a bad word.
No.
No. And so now he has a daughter who will grow up not knowing her father.
Nope.
And will actually grow up thinking, you know, that there are bad people in the world. It's a hard lesson to learn at such a young age that someone took your father away.
But there are bad people in the world.
Yes. Well, I know, but it's just hard for someone that young to have to learn it in such a complete way at such a young age.
Yeah. Well, and if I wouldn't say lucky. I mean, the majority of people never meet up with the truly bad people.
Yes. Well, that's one good thing. At least this type of thing is not usual.
Right.
Yes, but what about this? What was the girl ex-girlfriend's name? Babcock?
Laura Babcock.
Yeah. Now, her family has no idea what happened to her.
She's just disappeared.
She just disappeared, and obviously the police have information because they're pressing charges against Smitch and Millard on that. So that's yet to come.
Well, then I would ask, when did they get that incinerator?
I don't know. I think it was afterwards, but I'm not sure.
I mean, it was well prior to the disappearance of Basma.
Yeah. Yes, but there was that whole incident on YouTube that we saw of Millard renting a yacht in 2011, the summer of 2011, and taking a girl out on the yacht and then having blood on the yacht, and the girl wasn't there. But then this other girl disappeared like 6 months later in 2012.
Babcock.
So I don't know if that could have anything to do with her or if that would be another girl.
Maybe there's another girl.
Could be another girl.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the father, I mean... What does it take to take the life of your own father? That's just mind-boggling. And the thing is, this is probably the person that gave him so much in life.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I guess the grandfather started the business. He was the wealthy one, but the father took over and was still making progress in it and still continuing to be a financially very viable business.
Right. Yeah, but that wasn't good enough for him. He wanted more, and he wanted excitement, I guess.
Yeah, had to be.
So, just really a case that makes you think, for sure. Gives you a lot to think about.
It does.
Yeah. Until next week, I guess we're going to say goodbye. I did want to let people know that within the next couple of weeks, we're going to have some rewards available for people who join TieGrabber. We've got the $2 a month club, the $3 a month club, and our premium $5 a month club. And each tier will receive a reward for joining. So we'll have those up soon on our website, www.tiegrabber.com. Now, True Crime Brewery is available on iTunes, it's available on Stitcher, and it's available on Google Play. We would love a 5-star review, which we always share on the air on one of our episodes, and that really helps us to get new listeners as well, so that's important. In addition to that, we would love any kind of feedback that you would like to send us at truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com.
Well, and as Jill mentioned, this was a case from a lady in Canada.
So Karen, yeah.
Karen, who suggested this, and it was a brilliant suggestion.
Really a good one, yes. I like it.
So if anybody has cases that they think would be worthy of discussion, send them over.
Yeah, and we have a couple of beer suggestions that we'll probably use as soon as we have a crime in that area to talk about.
We might run out of crimes before I run out of beer.
We might. I hope so. The world needs more beer and less crime.
Exactly.
I would be happy if crime went away and it was just brewery.
Peace, love, and beer.
Peace, love, brewery. And we could get rid of the true crime part.
Okay.
Well, that'd be great. So I'd just like to say to all of our listeners, thanks for listening to True Crime Brewery.
And let's all take good care of each other until next time when we meet at the quiet end of the bar.
That's right.
Thanks.
Thank you. Goodbye.